What makes a human a human? And what would it mean for humanity to be abolished? C.S. Lewis has some ideas, and we're going to discuss them today when we discuss his book, The Abolition of Man. Good evening, good morning, good afternoon, everybody. Steve, I do not have a poem. Instead,
I was going to say, this is becoming a habit with you.
I know. Well, I haven't come empty-handed, though.
All right.
I just made up right now, something that my high school Spanish teacher called relámpago. Relámpago is the Spanish word for lightning, but he used it to mean lightning quick quiz. So
now that you got it out of Spanish into plain English, I'm nervous.
good. Well, hey, that word certainly inculcated fear in the ninth graders of St. Clair High School. Relámpago, everybody sits up straight. Okay, so, and now, since I'm throwing this lightning quick quiz at you, I realize that turnabout's fair play. So if you want to ask me any ridiculous questions about this reading after I do for you, that's fine. That's your prerogative, okay?
We'll see so if I here have any self-esteem left after
okay.
the quiz.
Okay, good. So the first question that I have regarding the abolition of man is there's the man who's like well-formed, right? But there are two other men that each deficient in one area. What are the titles of those men?
From Lewis.
That's right. So one, his head is too big, right?
Okay.
And the other, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The other is the one I think I know the name for.
Okay. What's the other?
The trousered ape.
Yes. Okay. Very good. You got that one. Nailed it. Trousered ape. I'm only kind of sure of the first one.
Okay. it's not the debunker.
It's not just basically, the debunker. Right. He fulfills that role, but I think the title that he gives the guy is Egghead.
Egghead. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, you got
okay,
that.
Okay. Okay. Sweet, sweet. All right, so together we got a 100% so far. Okay, how about this
but
one?
There's
yeah, go ahead.
There's another caricature in the story, the main one in the book, right?
What, like the well-formed guy?
No, the one that he's mainly going at. He gives the name to one of his chapters.
I don't know it.
Men?
Oh, yeah, right. Okay, men without chests.
Yes.
Right.
Which is the modern man, right? That's the most common kind of person you run into, it seems.
That's right. That's right. Okay. Okay. Good deal. So we have three sort of perversions of humanity, right?
Yes.
The egghead, the men without chests, the trousered apes. And we'll get to those later. But okay. I've got two more questions that I can think of.
Gotcha. Okay.
Another one is, what is the word that Lewis uses to describe sort of tradition or what others call natural law?
That he borrows from another culture?
Yes, he does. Very good.
Okay. So it's the Chinese word, the Tao.
The Tao. Yes. Very good. Spelled T-A-O, everybody look out, but it's pronounced Tao. At least that's how my teachers pronounced it. So
Chinese do not follow Western phonetics.
Right. That's right.
Their
phonetics are super old, so I think we can give it to them, no problem.
Right. It's probably more our fault than theirs, but anyway.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Okay, last one. This is what actually got me started on this ridiculous game anyway. You're familiar with Peter Kreeft? I'm just barely familiar with him. Okay.
Yeah.
So you could probably speak to his sort of realm better than me. I just know he's a Catholic philosopher professor. And so I saw on the Wikipedia page for The Abolition of Man that Peter Kreeft said that this book is one of the six books to read to save Western civilization. Okay? So high praise. Do you have any idea of what else might be on Peter Kreef's list?
So when I was in school, the problem I had with these pop quizzes is that I would often know the information, just not be able to remember the information, which my teachers believed meant I didn't know it. I know I read, he's got a wonderful work that I can't pull the title off the top of my head. Something about C.S. Lewis for the 21st Century Man or something like that. And he has wonderful, I don't, maybe five or six articles that he's written on Lewis. And I remember him talking about The Abolition of Man as one of those six books. Don't have a clue what the other five are.
Okay. Well, so I'll give you a... Do you want to take a guess at an author, or do you just want to sort of me to go off the list?
I feel like he was big on, I don't know which work, but I feel like there was a, now I can't even think of her name. Catholic author, can't keep a good man down, et cetera.
Flannery O'Connor?
Was Flannery O'Connor one?
No, she's not. Okay, but so. you're right to stay in the Catholic realm. Catholic authors, yes, for sure. Witty Catholic authors in particular.
So Chesterton?
Chesterton is on there twice.
So I'm guessing
C.S. Lewis is on there twice.
So if it's Abolition of Man, he's probably either Screwtape or Mere Christianity.
Yep, Mere Christianity. That's right.
Yep.
For Chesterton's?
Chesterton's probably is, well, he wouldn't do Man Who Was Thursday. Probably the Heretics and Orthodoxy.
Orthodoxy, yes. I've never even heard of Heretics, but The Everlasting Man is the other Chesterton.
Okay. All right, that makes sense.
Then we have a dystopian novel, two dystopian novels, actually.
Ooh, so Huxley and Orwell?
Huxley, good job. Yes, that's right. Brave New World. And the last one, I'm so excited to announce, Lost in the Cosmos.
Oh!
Walker Percy,
which is sort of a foreshadowing of the fact that we're planning some stuff with Walker in the not too distant future. So stay
that's
tuned.
That's right. This ridiculous end-around backdoor segue was just to say, I like Walker Percy, and we're going to talk about one of his books in the future. So, all right, enough of that.
I won't give you more questions, but I will piggyback on your segue.
Cool.
And say that with my students, two of their favorite individuals to interact with in our classroom are certainly Lewis and Chesterton, who are separated by a little time, but still very much of the same spirit. I mean,
right.
One's a Catholic and one's a Anglican, but their ability to poke fun at the seriousness of the modern enterprise,
right,
is just invaluable. Everybody wants to get so serious and really yell at each other, and Chesterton probably beats Lewis at this, but they're both pretty good at it. Chesterton in particular just comes along and takes his index finger and just jabs it into somebody's eye and says, and typically very, when he says something, you're almost, your first reaction is that's oversimplification. And then you just, you realize that he's brilliant, that he has simplified it down to its essence and he's doggone right.
Yeah. Chesterton, I think you're right. I think Chesterton takes the gold for that particular remaining, like, it's not exactly mirthful, but it's this playfulness and distillation in the face of seriousness. But man, C.S. Lewis, he's a bit more refined, right?
Yeah.
But he's excellent at it as well.
Well, Lewis is bringing in the academics. I mean, he argued these things quite formally at mm-hmm. Oxford and Cambridge. Chesterton was allowed a little less earnestness in saying his things. But to get to Abolition of Man, it is one of the great books on education that I've ever read. And it fascinates me that one of the things that's bothered me about modern education has been its, for lack of a better term, progressive nature. That mm-hmm. every 5-10 years, something new has got to come out that's going to change the world educationally, and it doesn't.
Right.
And that part of what I think both you and I have been involved in to some extent is a hearkening back to, well, there are some things that have worked pretty well over a long period of time in a lot of different cultures. Can't we kind of keep those things? And then if you want to fiddle around with other things, great. Maybe there are things that we can come into that are at least so old that they feel new or whatever. Mm-hmm, but Lewis saw, much like Orwell, much like Huxley, I think to a degree, Percy, these guys, kind of the modern prophets, right? They looked at their time and extrapolated from that 50 years down the road, what can we expect if we keep applying this? And so I just don't think Lewis realized in his lifetime how right he was mm-hmm. by the time you get to our lifetime, right?
Yeah, that's right. And so I think that's a good sort of summary of, I guess, Lewis's views. Well, I don't know if I want to summarize Lewis. That seems like a pretty big task. But one of the things that we're after in this book, I think, is this notion of not doing away with the new, like he says, right? So there's two ways. Okay, so the first part of the book is a lot of talking about the Tao, natural law, objective value, these sorts of things. Pause right here, because this book is not very long. Like, you can listen to an unabridged version of it, an audiobook, in 1 hour and 36 minutes. I know, because that's what I just did, right? It's not in preparation for this. I thought, well, I'll just listen to it again. And it's quite short, also quite meaty, hard to get through quickly, but it's dense and it's really great. And so what I want to say, though, is that first bit he's talking about, there's two ways to criticize the Tao. Right. Two ways to criticize. I'm going to gloss Tao as tradition. OK. Even though it's not exactly that.
Right. OK.
So there's two ways to criticize it, from outside of it or from inside of it. And I think a pretty good parallel here would be sort of the way that the Amish community interacts with technology. Many people want to say, Amish people are Luddites. They swear off technology. That's not actually the case. Instead, their view is, we don't know how that's going to affect our community. And so we are going to accept technological change at our pace rather than the pace of technological change. Right? So they put something above technology, namely, community. So I think that's one way that he's sort of working out man's role, right? I think that Lewis would commend the Amish community for placing humanity above tool use, right?
So I like his use of the parts of the body. Mm-hmm. I think he's concerned that some people are becoming all head or rationale. Mm-hmm. In particular, I would say through both abstraction and reduction, mm-hmm. but they're kind of becoming the scientists, right, who accept nothing other than what makes rational sense, at least as they define it.
Mm-hmm. And then, you said, the debunker, right? Somebody who's debunking everything,
right? All feeling, all traditional sentiment,
right?
That's what he uses. Is mm-hmm. is just a sort of a chemical response. It's not important. It doesn't mean anything. It's interesting that they kind of both go in the same direction, but one man puts it all in the hands of reason and the other man puts it all in the hands of the stomach or the appetite or mm-hmm. the base desire. He really right. sees us as animals as well. And we should stop trying to refine the animal, but just let it go.
Right.
And it's sort of a hedonist, but I don't think Lewis was intending for it to wind up as hedonism. He's just saying that the third organ that seems to be neglected is the one in the middle, right? You have your head telling you what to do. You got your stomach or your appetites making you want certain things. Mm-hmm. And he's pretty – I love Lewis. He's very forthright about what he means. Certainly there's a lust for power, but that we're talking about sexual lust. We're talking about any of the lusts, any of the appetites that modern man has, including a lust for the new and the technological consumption right. of things and whatnot. In the middle is supposed to be a chest. Mm-hmm. In the middle is supposed to be what the scripture would call a heart. Mm-hmm. A conscience, a valuer,
yep.
a seat of judgment, where at times it tells the head, you're running away with reason here, and there's more to it than just the simplicity that you've logically. And then, of course, it's on a regular basis, having a little chat with the stomach about you want too much.
Right.
You know,
right.
if I let you have that, it's going to kill you.
Yep, that's right.
And so it's the regulator, it's the governor, it's the seat where proper judgment is made, right mm-hmm. from wrong, too much, too little, just enough. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really in large part, the first section of the book is yeah. trying to show the dysfunction, the chestlessness of the modern man, that he's either ran to the head or ran to the stomach and has made a bugaboo of humanity by giving to one organ more than its due weight.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. And so, like you said, in education, you either then just approach the head or try and manipulate the appetites for that which is civically, I don't know what's the word.
Yeah, not even prudent, right? It's efficient.
Yeah, like, efficiency. Exactly. Yeah. That's where he would. And what I love is that when you read something fairly, like you said, short but dense, straight, and then you go to his fiction, in particular, Chronicles of Narnia are wonderful with this, because in a couple of places throughout that seven book series, you see, for instance, the school that Eustace goes to, mm-hmm. is an experimental, scientifically run debunking school. I'm sure they have plenty of green books right. there.
Yes.
And you see in the student the awful result of not teaching the whole man, mm-hmm. of only teaching to the head. Mm-hmm. And it takes real life and it takes Aslan and et cetera to convert and repair and fill out Eustace's head before he's of any use to anyone. Mm-hmm. And it's not a fun process for him, but right. Lewis is saying it can be done. We don't have to give up. Oh, look at how bad it is in the modern world. Give up. I mean, I think we've tried to champion that proper attitude here on the podcast that
right.
there's not a time in which education's just over. Let's just mm-hmm. give up and go. We have to do this thing. How do we do it well? So I love the first section because it sets up this wonderful problem. I would love to read the ending of that chapter because it's one of my favorite passages in not just this book, but in much of Lewis's writing.
Okay, good. I want you to because I felt you transitioning to the second part, and I thought, oh my gosh, we can't get out of this first part without saying sort of what Lewis says the role of the educator is, right? So this is the part where he says, for every one of this kind of student, we have a bunch more of this kind of student. Is that right?
Well, I don't, so my problem is that I've got notes in front of me instead of an actual copy of the book, which okay. I managed to leave at school today. So I'm not even sure if my favorite quote is the end of chapter one or the end of chapter two. You'll have to tell me.
Okay.
But to me, he builds this argument that in modern education, we either seek to take all sentiment, all notion of nobility, all notion of virtue out of education, mm-hmm. or we seek to give false virtues, false sentiments of a wholly humanistic, really propaganda.
Yeah.
And that at the end, the way he summarizes it, and I always get a gasp from people when I read them this, because he's purposely trying to make us stop and go, whoa, is it really that bad? He says, in a sort of ghastly simplicity, we remove the organ and demand the function.
Right.
We make men without chests and expect of them virtue and enterprise. We laugh at honor and are shocked to find traitors in our midst. And here's the zinger. Here's the one that makes the gasp.
Yep.
We castrate and bid the geldings be fruitful. We tell kids education's everything and then try and provide them a very practical, efficient, neutered education that'll get them a safe bid at a safe job where they can have safe lives.
Right.
Or conversely,
we tell them, we educate them only in the barest, most practical and reduced form of the word, and then we expect a virtuous life out of them.
Yep.
Either case, the student's a fool because we made him that way, and we're fools for expecting what we expect.
Yeah, we went to a Ford lot and we're shocked to find all we could find was Chevys.
Right.
And we're like, what? And that's the, I think a lot of the impetus behind the reform movements is we keep thinking, well, we just did it wrong. Mm-hmm. But we keep, in essence, in principle, doing the same thing and over and over, giving it a different shine and a different aspect. But it's still either aimed at the head or aimed at the stomach. The chest is forgotten.
It's still forgotten.
And that transitions you to his second point, which is where the Tao comes in. That's when he builds this case mm-hmm. that all humans know the basics.
Right.
And he talks some about what is included in that or whatnot, that traditional morality, which is under attack, in part because it states that it doesn't make any difference how you feel about it or how you rationalize it, it is. Mm-hmm. And that's a problem when man doesn't want to conform to what is, but wants to conform what is to himself.
Mm-hmm.
He's got to find a way around things like you know, Aquinas' notion of natural law, or that's what Lewis is doing. Lewis just says, right. Look, I can go to the Chinese. They understood this, that there is a certain way in which man lives
right.
in happiness.
Right. Which I think is really a brilliant move for Lewis, just sort of by the way, right? That he's not, like he says, hey, I'm a theist, I'm even a Christian, but what I'm not advocating for, this is not like a sort of backdoor route to a theistic argument, right?
Right,
What I'm talking about here is not the West as it is so often maligned today, right? What he's saying is, I'm talking about humanity in its most basic form. Like this is what everyone has known and knows to be true. It's only he wouldn't say this probably, but it's only the most learned that can deny it. You have to be taught how to deny it.
Yep. And I don't think man's going to try and learn how to overcome it without some sort of an agenda,
mm-hmm.
without a real motivation to fly in the face of what man has naturally known throughout his existence.
Right.
So I think that's a lot of what he's seeing way back. I don't know the date for this, but I'm guessing it's
I think it's
pre-World
War II
or right around there. Yeah, if the 40s. Yeah, that's what I was guessing.
43.
Okay. So he's watching as the curve begins. And of course, here we are a number of years later. The 60s are now well behind us, and the almost seems like several cultural revolutions have occurred. But the revolution has been about overthrowing tradition. Mm-hmm. About getting rid of what we all know we ought to do, mm-hmm. and redefining it, changing it, as he says, sort of coming up with a new Tao. Mm-hmm. And you can't pitch humanity and still be humans. It seems so obvious, right?
Yeah,
almost seems Chestertonian, right?
Right. Well, to what? How did he say it? To like eliminate the organ and demand the function.
Right. That we put a gelding in the pen and expect to get horses. No, I'm sorry. Right. It's incapable of doing that. And you expect, that's that middle part there. We laugh at honor. We debunk. We make all our heroes silly. Mm-hmm. Men of flesh. I think with my teaching of history, how many times my students have attacked the character of the founding fathers or whatnot, and thus everything they did is wrong. Mm-hmm. Well, no. But we laugh at honor and are shocked to find traitors in our midst.
Yeah.
It's like we just didn't see what we were doing. And I'm not totally convinced of that. I think there was at least some people very conscious of what they were doing, but wanted the agenda was to do away with traditionalism so that it wasn't any longer binding on their conscience. Mm-hmm. Right. And
which is totally understandable, I think, right? Like, when you have a society that is, or even elements of society that are preventing you from doing what you want to do, like if the power that you have to distort that society or to change it, you say, oh wow, look at this, I can just do away with these old-fashioned notions of humanity, and I can usher in and redefine the human as what I want it to be. Like, yeah, sure, I can see why a person would be tempted to do that, right? To not have to, well, I mean, history is full of men and women, mostly men, who did exactly that, right? Who were in a position of power and did something foolish because it was in their best interest. Well, because it made them feel good, right?
Right. They perceived it as being good.
Right. Right.
And
it brought them pleasure, I think, would probably be even better than, say, made them feel good.
Well, I mean, but I think this, I don't want to wrestle too hard here, but mm-hmm. he's got both motives. Either it makes idealistic sense,
right?
Which the 20th century saw idealism,
right?
Very rational. I'm going to think this. Here's the problem with mankind. It's this idea, and I'm going to just push it, even mm-hmm. if it's very inhumane to do so. Or what you're saying, I think, is the appetitive problem that I frankly don't care if it makes sense or not. In the moment, it promises me pleasure. Mm-hmm. Gulp, you know.
Right. I can get what I want. So right. Consequences be.
Yeah. Well, we can ask forgiveness later. Right.
Right.
As long as that conscience isn't there or is so buried in justifications mm-hmm. and noise. If education has taught you to ignore your conscience, you're going to have problems in society. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they've said ignore your conscience. They've said it really isn't what it seems.
Right. Which Lewis addresses, right? He says it's different to attack a value system, the Tao, the Tao. It's different to attack the Tao from a place of value, right? Saying, well, the Tao is wrong because there's some other value that's better or whatever. That's one thing. It's another matter entirely to say there is no such thing as value, which...
Or we're going to come up with a brand new one. Or we're going to... He has that whole discussion about the human mind can't come up with new value.
Right. Exactly.
Any more than it can come up with a new primary color.
Primary color, yeah. That's right.
Yes. And your mind stops and goes, well, you know, I can't imagine a new color. Right. I can imagine variations of the primary colors, right? That's the whole mm-hmm. color wheel. Mm-hmm. And you walk into Sherwin-Williams or something and good grief, have we gotten a little nuts?
Right. But,
and then we have to name them all. But anyway, but his point is there. You can't just create out of nothing. The Tao is open to criticism from within itself and open to change to some degree,
right.
growth with the context, but it's all coming from within itself, not someone coming from outside, which what would that be? It would have to be some new divinity.
Right.
Or maybe an alien comes to Earth and goes, now we have this value. Ooh, we never even seen that before.
Right. And so that's his thing, right? To go from, to attack the Tao from outside. Oh, well, what does he say? To attack the Tao, to destroy the Tao would be the branches revolting against the tree, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That you're a product of it. So you can't deny it. Unless, like, you're willing to say there's no such thing as value. Like, this whole project has gotten off the ground in the wrong way entirely. And there's just, and I think that's the more insidious tack to take. However, I do think that that notion, almost like a nihilism, right, is just, I think it's becoming more, I don't know about popular, but it's gaining a foothold, perhaps, you know, that maybe it didn't enjoy. Although I wasn't around in the 40s and I am not widely read in this time period, so it could have been just as prevalent then as today. But that does seem to me, at least, to be the scarier of the options, right? As long as someone is saying, oh, these notions of value, they're all wrong because what you should really be valuing is this. That's I can have that conversation.
Sure.
It becomes scarier, I think, when someone says, no, there's nothing. Right.
Well, not so much nothing as it's all subjective.
Right.
It's right. all determined by the moment, by your own feelings or by context or what's convenient or all of those are values to the modern. Right.
Right. Right.
A value is only a value if it's efficient, or a value is only a value if it profits me or brings me pleasure. And so they've adopted this singular value mm-hmm. and are now trying to get all other values to bow down. Not by an objective discussion, but by simply saying, well, fine, if you want to do what you want to do, but I want to do what I want to do. And we have to be able to do even opposite things and smile at each other.
Right.
And the Tao won't allow that. Right.
Uh-huh.
So the values in this new modern view to mm-hmm. me are just another piece of nature.
Mm-hmm.
They're all part of the package. And the modern mind is to conquer all nature,
right.
usually through applied science.
Right, which is maybe, kind of the back half, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Or applied science and evolution. Just mm-hmm. just the
progress.
We're just naturally going to select the best and leave the lesser behind.
Mm-hmm.
And the old notion of nobility, of honor, of
love.
Love doing the right thing because you ought to is maybe that worked for a while, but in this complex modern society, we got to start leaving those things behind, or we're going to start ruining ourselves. We're going to start hurting ourselves.
That's a really important point of the back half, right? For Lewis really brings out this notion that for man, there's this idea that man is conquering nature, but that isn't really the case. What we say when we say, or what we mean when we say man is conquering nature is really man is conquering other men, or man is conquering a part of himself. And so, yeah, it's a lot to unpack maybe in a podcast, but it's worth it.
He uses these great pictures, right? We use technology to learn how to throw bombs from airplanes.
Mm-hmm.
But there's people down below having that are now able to be bombed. Both sides of that, right? Yeah. Yes, yeah. The technology allows me to do something I've never done before. It also allows others to do to me what I've never had to endure before.
That's right.
He goes to birth control, right?
Yeah.
And says we now have all of this technology to control birth rates and whatnot.
Which is one generation essentially asserting control over another by refusing its existence.
There are existences not allowed to exist.
Yeah.
And that so it's really asking the question, who is benefiting as we grow in our ability to exercise power over nature? Like you said, we're really not changing nature.
Mm-hmm.
We're just growing in power to manipulate one another.
Right.
And to exercise control over each other. That to me, that starts to really get scary.
Sure.
And it's fascinating to me that all of this is couched in the place of education.
Mm-hmm.
That on a daily basis, hour by hour, for years, we're either moving toward one vision or another. And if this modern vision, where humanity obtains full control over itself,
mm-hmm.
right, that human nature will be the last part of nature to surrender to man. Wow.
Yep. Yeah.
Wow.
It is. Yeah, it's heavy stuff for sure. So, okay, let me you always ask four questions when you talk about a book, right? What are they?
Oh, what does it say? What does it mean?
Okay.
How much of it's true and so what?
All right. I think we've covered the first two pretty thoroughly.
Yep, and dabbled with the third.
Yeah, I agreed. So then, so what? What do you think about this? So what now, I guess?
So at least for me as a teacher, and I recognize this is a podcast on education, not a podcast
allegedly
on philosophy or something like that. But it all works together. You know, he talks about the fact that the so what here is what you're willing to gain and give up. In particular, what are you willing to give up in order to gain whatever it is this modern notion offers? The magician's bargain.
Mm-hmm.
Right. You were born a complete human. If in order to empower some part of that humanity, you have to give up some other essence of that humanity, is it worth it? And I think in particular, he's talking about the chest, the soul,
right.
The conscience. Are you really becoming better just because you're gaining power?
Mm-hmm.
And so my students and I talk about this a great deal in philosophy class, in English class, in any class that I'm a part of. It's not that it's either power or love, but the two are very feisty bedfellows.
Mm-hmm.
To the extent that one seeks one, there is a sense of diminishing the other. And we live in a world of power.
Right.
Love is really hard today. Mm-hmm. I think the Christian call, by this shall all men know that you are my disciples if you have love one for another, not if you can rule the world, but if you can rule yourself, right?
Mm.
And so I think that's the so what that I get out of all of this. There is a way man ought to live. For many years, the West did a pretty good job of at a local community level, I think at a family level, imparting virtue to young hearts so that regardless of where they went with their education, they were good people.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere along the line, in the modern mind, this has changed. And it's become, you know, all learning is power. All knowledge is power.
Right.
And so I go to school to become more powerful.
And to inoculate yourself against the powers that others have, right?
Well, the powers that others have, and to stop hearing that chest that says, well, maybe this isn't all of it. No, mm-hmm. No. It is. Just ignore that little voice. It's sad, but it gives me great hope because I see a lot of frustration and sadness, I'd say depression, in many of my students' lives because they haven't been told that they're fully human.
Hmm.
Some specific aspect that for many of them, frankly, just, it doesn't sound that interesting other than there's money at the end of it. You know, they feel there's something more. And Lewis says there is.
Right.
You've That's just right. reduced humanity down to something less than it really is. And the full orbed humanity that they thankfully, I don't have to display it for them. I would be a poor shot at it. Mm-hmm. But great literature just stalks these people out there for them to look at. And they That's go, right. you know, the Red Cross Knight or Arthur or Beowulf for crying out loud or Achilles or Odysseus mm-hmm. or, you know, the list just goes on and on and on.
Patroclus, my personal favorite character of go. Odyssey. I love there Patroclus. Don't get me started.
Yeah. Yeah. But they're fiction that allows my students to go, ooh, what's behind all of that?
Right.
And seek not to debunk it, as Lewis is saying, mm-hmm. not to get rid of the sentiments, but to become better informed and better formed in, as you and I say all the time, the wisdom and virtue that's at the heart of good education.
And I agree. I think for me, the sort of early in the book, he puts this dichotomy in place that resonates for me through the whole work. And that is one of propaganda or propagation, right?
Mm,
and
yes.
So we as teachers, man, it is way easier to propagandize than to propagate. It is so much easier to just come in. Here's what you need to know, everybody. See you later. And interact not as humans, right? But it is much easier to propagate, or I'm sorry, it is much easier to propagandize than it is to propagate humans, to nourish, to, well, like we say, cultivate wisdom and virtue. That's a much steeper task. It's much more difficult. And it requires the best in us. But that is the call. Right. That is what we are supposed to do. And so, yeah, that distinction is crucial. And when I remember it, I teach better. You know, when that's right. it is on my mind, then I am more engaged and I am calling my students to the higher things. To go back to sort of, well, one thing that we didn't really talk about that's big is the ordering of loves. Right.
Mm.
So this book, I think for teachers and for, I would say, humans, helps us think about how our loves are ordered and how they ought to be ordered. And when they are ordered rightly, that's good. That's evidence that we're living well.
Yeah. I just invite our listeners to not let the excitement that Jason and I have about this book and our sincere desire to give you all of it as fully as we can in the limited time, the best thing to do is leap in and, like he said, either listen to it or read it. It's not long. It's not difficult. We probably made it sound a whole lot more difficult than it really is. It's at that such a basic level. You're not going to walk away with 10 new ideas for your classroom or for homeschooling or for, but you're going to walk away going ennobled, right?
Right.
I just feel better about being a person.
Yeah.
And I would contest that that's really what you want your student to walk away from class feeling as well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, sure, wow, that was a really interesting lesson, but much more importantly, God's great and I'm his child and I'm a king for I rule myself type thing.
That's
you know,
right.
I think that'd be great.
Yeah, not a book on tricks, not a book on method. This is a book about ends, right? Where are we headed?
Don't eat your vegetables.